Well, maybe the more interesting question would be, how do we do that? Well, obviously I won't answer this question too, but I can just sketch you the path. First, when you want to quantize a classical theory, you have two main approaches. The first one, which has been very successful in quantizing electromagnetism, or to formulate yes, quantum theories for the standard model, for example, is the Lagrangian or path integral approach. But in the case of gravity, the problem is that it leads to a non-renormalizable theory. That means that you have infinite numbers that you cannot control. The second approach is the Hamiltonian one, in which, well, you saw it in your first elementary quantum mechanics courses, the main equation, which, let's say the yes, most important equation, is the Schrödinger's equation, and for this formulation you need a Hamiltonian and a time. The problem here is that in the case of gravity, in general relativity, you have no time because your theory is, you have no preferred coordinate because the theory is invariant under the change of coordinates. The theory is invariant under diffeomorphisms. You can show that if you want to formulate gravity with the Hamiltonian way, the dynamics is encoded in constraints. And the one of those constraints is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So first, I want to talk a little about the path which exists between the classical and quantum theory of gravity to introduce the main concepts, the main ideas that I want for the rest of the talk. After, I'm going to talk about very special quantum states of space, which are spin network states. And finally, I will talk about the quantization of Hamiltonian constraints in this framework. So from classical to quantum gravity, I will focus here on 3D gravity. So you have to, from now and until the end of this talk, you live in a flattened space, in a two-dimensional space. You're a flattened audience, and you have time as a third dimension. In the original formulation of gravity, of GR, you all know that the action is the Einstein-Hilbert action, and from which, using a variational principle, you can obtain the Einstein's equation in vacuum. So I took a zero cosmological constant, which is the fact that the Ricci tensor is zero. You say that the space-time is Ricci flat. There is an additional thing which is very special to very specific to three-dimensional gravity. It is the fact that you have a linear relation between the Riemann and the Ricci tensors, so that if the Ricci tensor is zero, then the Riemann tensor is zero too. So that your spacetime is not only Ricci flat; it is totally flat. So we say that 3D gravity has no local degrees of freedom, and as physical consequences, you have no gravitational force between two-point particles, and because the information cannot propagate, and of course you have no gravitational wave. You could say that this theory is therefore unphysical and not really interesting because trivial, but that's not true. It's not trivial. And you can consider it as maybe a toy model to understand more what happens geometrically, or to understand more fundamental things, to apply them in 4D gravity. So let's talk about the Hamiltonian formulation of GR. The first one, which have been formulated by Arnowitz, Beser, and Misner, it's called the ADM formalism. And the basic idea is, well, you need a time, so you take an arbitrary coordinate in space-time, you call it, you are the time, and then you define the space as into the space-time as surfaces defined by t equal to constant. So in three dimension, in three-dimensional space-time, you have coordinates x mu, and you split them between two coordinates for space, xa, x1, x2, and a coordinate for time. The metric is also split into first the qab, which is the two metric, the metric which defines the intrinsic properties of space. And because, of course, it doesn't contain all the information about your geometry of your whole space-time, you had to add new variables which actually explain what is the behavior of the last coordinate, of the time coordinate, and which are the correlations between space and time coordinates. And finally, the Ricci tensor can be also seen as splitted between two parts. The first part, which is RAB, it's the intrinsic curvature of space. And KAB is what we call the extrinsic curvature. It explains basically what is the curvature of your two-dimensional surface, of your space surface, with respect to the curvature of space-time. Basically, the idea is the following. Imagine that you have a sphere which is embedded in our three-dimensional, let's say, flat space. If you take a given vector, so on the sphere, and if you want to parallel transport it with respect to the geometry, the connection of space-time, which is flat, you parallel transport, you have something like this. But then, if you parallel transport according to the connection to the geometry of the intrinsic geometry of your of the sphere, you get something which is like this. The difference between those two ways of parallel transporting the a vector is precisely given by the extrinsic curvature. It's a curvature with respect curvature of space with respect to the curvature of space-time. Well, with those variables, so you have a splitted space into space-time, you have a time, you can then define a Hamiltonian, you can have a Hamiltonian formulation, you can define canonical momenta conjugate to the metric, and the Hamiltonian density by the usual Legendre transformation. And what you get is a very special form, which is given here. N is the lapse. I forgot to give the names, but this is called the lapse. This is called the shift. And they appear here, the lapse multiplying this function C of QP and the shift multiplying this function. Those two functions, C and V, are called the Hamiltonian and the vector constraints. And why do we call them like this? It's because they vanish on shell. They are really constraints which explain how you're supposed to, they restrict your configuration space, basically. Like if you want to study the movement of a particle on a 2D surface, but saying that you have actually a 3D space, you have to give an equation which says that your particle is bound to be on the surface. That's what those constraints say, basically. And the Hamiltonian constraint, which is, in one sense, somehow the most important one, it encodes the basic information on how your space is supposed to be embedded in space-time. So this equation here is the expression of the Hamiltonian constraint in terms of P and Q. You can show that P, the momentum conjugate to the metric, the two metric, is directly related to the extrinsic curvature. So you have a relation between the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature. And remember that you expect your equations of motion to give you a flat space-time in 3D. So this is exactly what you have. If your space is curved, then it needs to be curved with respect to the flat space-time. Well, so we could right now, using those variables, we could quantize very naively our theory, saying my Hamiltonian is an observable, an operator on a Hilbert space. But the problem is that on using those variables, the quantization is not easy. So we introduce new ones. And the basic idea is the following. In the Einstein-Hilbert action, the key point, the key variable is the Ricci scalar, the curvature of your scalar curvature of space-time. And in differential geometry, you can show that you have actually, by definition, the fact that the notion of curvature and the notion of measuring distances are separated. The only structure that you need to express a curvature or a torsion of a manifold is what we call a connection. In the original formulation of GR, we take tacitly, explicitly, the fact that the connection that you consider is the Lebesgue-Vita connection associated with the metric, which is the only connection which is metric preserving and torsion free. But you're not forced to do that. And the proposition is the following. You promote the connection as an independent variable with respect to the metric. So you separate the notion of, yes, back to the origin, separate the notion of curvature and the notion of distance. So the new variables that we're going to use are the following. The first, a connection one form, which contains the information about the connection, the curvature. It's a one form which is SO3 valued, so which is isomorphic to SU2. They are actually just anti-symmetric matrices in 3D, in 3-3 matrices. And the second variable you use is a triad, or Dreibein in German. It's simply a set of three vector fields which defines a local frame in your space-time. And this is something that enables you to reconstruct the metric. That's the idea. So let's say that this is put instead of G, and this is put instead of R. When you express the Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of those new variables, you have the Palatini action, Palatini formalism. There is a remarkable fact about those variables. It's the fact that they are naturally conjugate in the Palatini action. This is very okay. It is shown here. The triad is the canonical momentum, the conjugate to the connection one form. Again, the Hamiltonian density that you get is a combination of constraints. You have, as before, the Hamiltonian constraint C and the vector constraint V. And you have an additional one, which is called the Gauss constraint. It basically stands for an SU2 invariance. The fact that you introduced a triad to reconstruct the metric added extra degrees of freedom, because if you had a triad, and if you take another, which is just obtained by your rotation, you get the same metric. So you need something which tells you that it doesn't matter how your triad is turned. It's an SU2 symmetry, and the invariance is given by this law. So now we are ready to quantize, and I won't give a lot of details, but just the basic idea. By a comparison with elementary quantum mechanics. In your first courses of quantum mechanics, you used the configuration space. Okay, let's consider that you are studying the movement of a particle in one dimension, so in an axis. Its level, the position is described by a number x. The analog of this position x is the connection one form A. The analog of the wave function, psi, it's what we call a cylindrical function. So it is a functional of the connection. In quantum mechanics, in elementary quantum mechanics, you have a position operator which acts on wave functions by multiplication. It's exactly the same here, and the momentum operator, P, which acts as a derivative with respect to x, the same here. You have a triad operator, which acts basically as a functional derivative with respect to the connection. Well, yes, you don't know, I think not. Okay, some people among you don't know what is a cylindrical function. I can just give you some elements. So there is a basic object, geometric object, which is a functional of a connection, and it's called a holonomy. So a holonomy along a graph, along a curve, gamma. In the manifold, it's basically the object which tells how a vector is parallel transported along the curve. So you have v0, you have here v1, which is the parallel transported of v0 along this curve, which is unique, and the operator which gives v1 in terms of v0, it's the holonomy h gamma of a along the curve and apply to v0. So it's a kind of rotation. You can see it as a rotation. And it is an element of SU2, basically. What is a cylindrical function? It's just a kind of generalization. Can you see what I'm writing? Okay. It's just a kind of generalization of this simple idea. If you consider a graph, which is simply, edges with vertices, edges, you can wonder how it is embedded in two space. I'm sorry, this graph, gamma. You can wonder how vectors are parallel transported along the edges, which stands for the curves here. And so you affect a holonomy to each link. And the cylindrical function is just a means to take each holonomies on each link and to take all of them and to give you just a complex number. So that's the analog of a wave function. I talked about the triad operators. I said that they act as functional derivative with respect to the connection. You can show that actually this definition leads you to a distribution. So you need to regularize it. And you do that defining fluxes, which are just a kind of smearing of the operator, the triad operator, along the curve. And you can show that choosing your curve gamma conveniently, those fluxes have a very simple effect on cylindrical function. They just insert a generator of SU2 on the right or on the left of the corresponding holonomy. Yes, because you have a label of fluxes, which is an edge of the graph. And you have to precise if it's acting at the source or at the target. And yes, you see that the action is quite simple. And moreover, those operators have a very nice geometric interpretation as vectors. But to see that, you have to apply them on very special states, which I'm going to describe right now. They are spin network states. So I said that the analog of wave functions, which are quantum state of space or space-time, they are cylindrical function. You need a graph and you need a function f. The graph here for spin network state is basically called a spin network. It is an orienting graph, which is colored by irreducible representations, that is to say, spins on edges, and intertwiners on vertices. I guess that you are all used to the notion of irreducible representations of SU2 because they are, yes, basically spins. But the notion of intertwiner is maybe not really known. You can see them basically as, okay, the intertwiner here, it intertwines three irreducible representations of SU2. It is just a vector which is invariant under the action of SU2 via the tensor product of those three representations. That's the basic idea. So from this graph, you can define a function called the spin network function, and which is defined something like this. So you have a product on the edges, and you have the contribution, which stands for the contribution of each group element that you take. It is a function which takes n elements of SU2 and which gives you a complex number. So you have to describe what is the dependence on the group elements, and this dependence is given by the representations which are associated with each edge. And the contribution of intertwiners is given here. I won't detail it, but they are present. Okay, this dot here stands for a kind of index contraction that I won't detail here. And then the spin network state is defined naturally by this graph, so the spin network, and the spin network function, which is associated, which stands for the function, and you have this state defined like this. What is the interest of those states in low quantum gravity? The first one is that they are automatically gauge invariant states. Actually, by construction, that's the reason why we added intertwiners. You remember they are invariant under SU2. That's why we introduced those objects. It's just to make the state invariant under SU2. And the second interest is more physical. It's the fact that they have a very nice geometric interpretation in terms of triangulation. So consider a two surface. You can approximate it by simply gluing triangles to reproduce the curvature of your space, of your surface. And a spin network state is exactly, a wave function. It's exactly a state, a quantum state that represents this kind of triangulation. The correspondence is the following. At each vertex of the spin network, you associate a triangle of the triangulation. At each link, you associate the edge of a triangle, so you have three. And the length of the edge corresponding to a link is given by the square root of je plus 1, where je is the spin which is associated to the edge, the link of the spin network. And now, why this correspondence is meaningful is because of this. If you consider a vertex of a spin network and its dual triangle, which is in gray here, you can show that the action of the flux observables is precisely related to the vectors which are given by the triangulation. Because if you take the scalar product of two, let's say, if you take this, if you take the observable which acts at these points, and you take the scalar product and you act on a spin network, you can show that the spin network state is an eigenvector of this observable, and the eigenvalue is the length associated to the triangulation. And you have the same thing for scalar product between two different observables. You get basically the scalar product between those two vectors. So now we have a very nice interpretation, geometric interpretation of our observables or geometric observables when they act on spin networks. And we're going to use them to quantize the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is the idea of Valentin for quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint. You want to use those fluxes operators to probe the flatness of spacetime. And the idea is very simple. Taking those two vectors, when you take their scalar product, and then when you parallel transport this one, and you take the scalar product after this operation, they are supposed to be the same, because our spacetime is supposed to be flat. It's what our Hamiltonian constraint says. So the proposal is the following. For the quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint, we take this operator C12, which is the difference between the scalar product before parallel transport and the scalar product after parallel transport. And you have me here, which stands for the parallel transport. So I guess just a remark, comparison between the classical expression of the constraint and the quantized version. You can show that in triad connection formulation, the Hamiltonian constraint has this form. F is the curvature 2 form, which is associated with the connection 1 form A. And so we have this quantized version. And so basically, the quantization pattern is to associate the triad to a flux, which is natural. We saw that it was just a smearing of the corresponding operator. And you associate the curvature F with this expression, which says it's the identity minus a kind of rotation. So it is meaningful. Now we consider we are going to see how this operator acts on spin network states, and let's start with the most simple one. Take a triangulation of the sphere, the most simple one, which is a tetrahedron. The corresponding spin network state is on the left here. It's also a tetrahedron. You can just convince yourself replacing. We put edges. Four edges, which are something like perpendicular cross it, and you can show that you have this this network. And so what do we get if we apply the constraints? This constraint, you act here with a flux on the H6 at the source, and you parallel transport, you compare it with the flux on the H2. What do we get if we say that the spin network state is in the kernel of this constraint? We get this. So the scalar product before parallel transport can be expressed this way. So I said before that it was the product of the length. It was because it's the basic interpretation of fluxes, the product of length and multiply by the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. This expression is exactly equivalent, actually, but it's written by a different way. This is called a 6J symbol, and it is a recoupling coefficient of three representations of SU2. And when you take the scalar product after parallel transport, you get this expression, which is okay. Let's see the most important. In this expression, you shift the spin J1, which is the one here. So when you have to, when you are going across along this edge, that generates a shift of the spin J1, the corresponding spin. So what do we get finally? If we say that those two things are equal, we get simply a recursion relation on the spin J1. So if you call U of J1 this object, define the spin network state associated with different J, you get, yes, a recursion relation of order 2 for U of J1. Which has basically this form. So this is the contribution before parallel transport. This is the contribution after parallel transport. And the solution of this recurrence relation is quite well known. It's the 6J symbol J1, J2, J3, J4, J5, J6. And you can show that it is actually a solution of this using quite well-known identity for 6J symbols, which is called the Biden-Arnold identity or pentagon identity. And so you naturally retrieve the fact that you have a space, flat space-time, because actually when you take the spin network function, the spin network state associated with this graph for the flat connection, you get exactly the 6J symbol. This evaluated for A equal to 0 give you a 6J symbol. So we recover a flat connection. That's not surprising. It's by construction, actually. But it gives you, well, now a new interpretation of those recurrence relations. It's a physical interpretation of the recurrence relations. Moreover, they have a very nice geometric interpretation. When you look at the asymptotics of the recursion relation for large spins, when you take all spins J1 to J6, which are large, you have the following relation. So the coefficient A0, it's just a product, is an exact relation. You don't need to have to study the asymptotics. You have a product of cosines. B, it's just a cosine of this angle. And in the large spin limit, A plus is equal to A minus, and it's proportional to the product of the sides of this angle and this angle. So if you write, I forgot to define, this is just stands for the shifting operator of acting on a given function. It's T1 on U of J1 is just U of J1 plus 1. And if you write this operator this way, introducing a new operator that you call theta, you obtain this asymptotic relation where this angle exactly corresponds to this angle. We can show that in geometry, this angle is related to the three angles here of the triangles by this relation. So you get really a geometric interpretation of these operators are cosines of dihedral angles. And that you can notice is that this angle is typically a three-dimensional property. It is related, really related to how you embed your space into space-time, because in space, in our two-dimensional space, we just have just can define the angles of the triangles, but this is really a three-dimensional property. So that you get is again a good relation with the Hamiltonian constraints, which tells you that your it tells you what is the relation between your surface, the geometry of your surface, and its embedding. It is really the same. So you have a relation between a three-dimensional property, three-dimensional quantity, and two-dimensional quantities. This operator is not the only one that you can generate using this idea. For example, you can wonder, how can I compute the volume of the tetrahedron? So I said that the fluxes could be interpreted as the vectors corresponding to the triangulation. So the most naive idea is to say the volume of my tetrahedron is just the determinant of those three vectors. But, well, there is a problem. You can take, for example, the vector, the cross product between those two observables, but you can't directly after take the scalar product with this one, because they are not defined with respect to the same vertex. And the vertex in this framework is just a frame. So to take this, to compute this determinant, you need to parallel transport the vector before. And but you have two ways to do that. You can do it like this, and you can do it like this. And this idea can generate a new constraint, because You can say if your spacetime is flat, those two ways to compute my determinant are the same. So that's a new idea, a new observable that you can test. And so you define this constraint operator, and you apply it on a spin network state. And what you get is, again, a recurrence relation. And this time, it shifts two spins. It shifts the spin J2 and the spin J6, which are so this one and this one. And again, when you look at the asymptotic behavior of this recurrence relation, you get this kind of relation with the same identity for the shift operators expressed in terms of theta. You get this nice expression, which is again a very well-known relation in for the geometry of a tetrahedron. And this is not finished. You can generalize this idea to, let's say, a more complicated spin network. So you take an arbitrary long plaquette, a pretty long face, and you can test those operators. So you can take, for example, this one. You take the vector which is here, with u parallel transport here, you compare with the other one. You can take another kind of volume, let's say volume, take the cross product here, and parallel transport another vector along different ways. We can also do something that I didn't present, but take one vector, take the scalar product with itself, then parallel transport and do the same. So that's another recurrence relation that you can generate. As an example, I would like to show you the result when you are doing something like this. You get this very nice recurrence relation on the spin network function. It shifts approximately everyone. So you have, yes, except these two spins, all the others are shifted. That's very complicated recurrence relations. And again, by constructions, they are solutions. Known solutions of those recurrence relations are 3n-1 J symbols, which are complicated symbols again. And finally, the question is, as for the tetrahedron, do you have a nice geometric interpretation of those of the asymptotic behavior of those recurrence relation? Well, not always, and the reason is the following. For a tetrahedron, if you have fixed this angle, and this angle, you have a tetrahedron which is unambiguous. You have one single tetrahedron which is given by this configuration, the gluing of the three triangles. And so the dihedral angle has a meaning. But if you take something more complicated, for example, so instead of taking a triangle for a spin network, you take a face which is a square. So it's the triangulation picture is this one. What is this dihedral angle? It has no sense, no meaning, because just giving the angles of all the triangles that you glue together, you don't have a fixed geometry. Because you can crush your pyramid, keeping the same angles, and that changes this angle. So it's logical that you cannot have a geometric meaning for the asymptotics of those general relations. And this is to be related to the fact that some solutions of those recurrence relations are just not geometric. For example, the 9J symbol is not a geometric object. So to conclude, we have found that using the loop quantum gravity variables, you could quantize the Hamiltonian constraints, and this quantization successfully reproduces the flatness of spacetime, which is just self-consistent. You can exhibit a consistent geometric meaning, a relevant geometric meaning of those relations, and they generate recursion relation on 3nj symbols, and which allows us to maybe understand better what is the meaning of those recursion, all those recursion relations which are satisfied by those symbols. But the problem which are remaining are the fact that the dependencies between all the constraint operators is really unclear. That's something on which we spent 1 month or calculated during 1 month. And we didn't find the relations between those, the dependence relations between those recurrence relations. And another problem which is related to that is the fact that the quantum constraint algebra is still unknown. So we, in particular, we don't know if the if it's anomaly free at the quantum level. So I would like to thank Valentin. I would like to thank all the quantum gravity group for its warm welcoming, and you for your attention. This is the most beautiful thing that you can see in Ontario, except 3NJ symbols. This is in Tobermory, sunset in Tobermory. That's really beautiful. So if you have the occasion, I encourage you to go and see that. Well.
Do you guys have questions about their works or Tobermory?
I mean, I have a question. You know, going back to this ABM formalism, right?
Yep.
I'm just fully, I just don't know enough to maybe.
I try to be clear, I'm sorry.
No, yeah, it's fine. I'm just, so GR in general is, you solve the equations up to the diffeomorphism, right?
Yep.
So it's a diffeomorphism on the of the four manifold. So I'm just wondering, how does it translate into when you split out space and time in the ideal formula?
Well,
how does diffeomorphisms of like four dimensional space translate?
Yes, they are splitted. They are splitted in two parts. You have space diffeomorphisms, which are generated by the vector constraints, and time diffeomorphisms, which are generated by the Hamiltonian constraint. Actually, you can show that they are those functions generate these invariants, those transformations.
So what you're saying is basically that it's in general that the four diffeomorphisms decomposes into.
Yeah. It's really you can say that at every level you have this the effect of this splitting between space and time. You know, you have this effect, okay, which is somehow artificially introduced, but you have. At the level of the variables, at the level of the metric, at the level of the curvature, you have always this splitting which can be seen.
Yeah, I mean, just at a point, what you can do is, I mean, if you want to check that you get some symmetry in the Hamiltonian formulation, you have to compute the algebra for the Poisson brackets. And then you can check that you indeed reproduce the algebra of the formalism. And for example, the vector constraint generates diffeomorphisms of the canonical surface, and this is a subalgebra of diffeomorphism.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can check this in the
topology. Yeah, but as far as I understand, the Hamiltonian constraint has no formal subalgebra, it doesn't close. And then
it does close.
At the classical level, it does.
It does?
Yeah.
Sure. So it's a Poisson bracket of Hamiltonian constraint. Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it closes with structure functions and not constant structure constants. So this is why you get
into. I think that this fact is due to the fact that we are not using always a coordinate basis, a coordinate frame on your. The description
of this is known as the Dirac algebra.
Yeah.
So
okay. Right. So, do you have a question about Tobermory?
What's the square head after the bounds?
Ah, sorry, yes. This is not a square. It stands for the two curvatures, the intrinsic curvature of space, Okay, I forgot to say that.
Mean on the right, it seems like a square of R.
Yes, that's why it's on the left. So the two is not related to it's related to the R. Yes, that's why I said that you have, in the Hamiltonian constraint, you have a relation between the intrinsic curvature of space and the extrinsic curvature.
This is the RAB. This RAB
comes
from RAB.
It's yes, RAA. Let's say the RAA. But for, I have to. I don't remember exactly how is made. How happens the splitting between the intrinsic properties and the extrinsic properties in the expression of the Ricci tensor. I don't remember exactly, but that can be found in textbooks.
So, so first question is that you have here a Hamiltonian constraint one.
Yeah.
You showed us it's equivalent with the spins and one recursion relation for the CJ symbol.
Yeah.
But then you went wild and you start writing several consistency equations and several recursion relations, which you interpreted as constraints. But they don't appear at the classical level in any way, those other constraints you got, with the scalar vector products, volumes, and so on.
Yep.
So what are those constraints? They are like extra things which appear at the quantum level, but not in the classical
you have, level. There is no reason why this relation would be preferred to this one. There is no reason. There are different propositions to quantize the Hamiltonian constraint, but there is not a direct path from the classical expression here. This classical expression, there is not a direct path. I don't just put hats on each quantity. It's not me. It's Valentin actually who did that. But well, yes, this is. Not this is not direct. It's the propositions, the proposal, but
So the thing is that you get this proposal and you get something, then you show another idea and you get another proposal. Are these two propositions of quantum constraints equivalent or not?
That's the problem. That's what we tried to show during 1 or 2 months.
Okay.
Because you can you see the face of those recurrence relations. They are quite complicated. To show the dependence of between, for example, this recursion relation and the other, which I obtained, that's not really easy. Technically speaking, the expressions are just that they take one page just to write one equation. So it's one page. So we tried a lot of methods, but we just failed. So that's an open problem. Sorry?
This psi
that yes, it's the one solution is the 6J symbol. We didn't okay.
So for the first Hamiltonian that you wrote, so actually you can solve it for the simple translation with just one fraction. You can solve it exactly and you just give one solution.
Which is
the 6J symbol. For the other proposal, so classically there are clearly consequences. There are satisfy classically as consequences of the real classical Hamiltonian. So one should get a quantum version.
We should show that all of the other ways to impose the constraint are actually just the translations of the.
Yeah, so the point that the other equations may be a bit weaker because they are just consequences of the Hamiltonian constraint. Mm-hmm. So they may be a bit weaker, and at the quantum level, they may allow for more solutions than just. So, but I mean, we don't know exactly where the full set of solutions. So we know the solutions that come from as you do your presentation. We don't know because these are recursion relations among a lot of students. So you may you have to specify an infinite number of initial conditions, except for the first relation and constraint that you have presented.
Okay, and I have another question. So if you go to the end of the presentation, the conclusions that you're talking about geometric interpretation, constant geometric meeting. So I almost got it with the tetrahedron because I understood that you can relate these constraints to the bilateral angle. Yep. But then you said if I go to pyramids, I actually can't do that. So I can't
I was I was talking about the one that we got for the tetrahedron. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not, this is not a general statement. Like
No, that's right.
Trying to find the geometric meaning.
That's right. Yeah. Or well, you can say that it has a geometric meaning in sense that it is related to a constraint on the connection. So in this sense, in this meaning, it's geometric.
But it does not
meaning.
Necessarily exhibit a precise fixed D geometry.
No. Yeah.
Well, for me, it still has some, because what happens is that you get this pyramid, and the point that you need 9 lengths to specify it completely,
yes.
And we only have 8. So what it means is that there's still one degree of freedom.
Yes.
So it's a geometric object up to 1 degree of freedom. And so what we get is that we get a relation whose solution is the whole family.
Yeah, and you can show that if you that something that that we proved, if you add the missing length, so that you consider that this pyramid just gluing two tetrahedra, then you can introduce those dihedral angles, and then you can show that the recurrence relation has a geometric meaning in terms of those those angles.
Your spin network also, if you treat this as two groups, the
tetrahedra. That doesn't split it. It's because here I just considered a part of the spin network, which is this. But then I didn't tell how those lengths are connected, and you have several ways to do it. If you are doing like this, you obtain just. This is actually just a product of two 6J symbols, and this corresponds to adding the missing length. And but you can also do a different thing. You can how to do that? Maybe to connect like this and like this. I think that's. And if you do that, you obtain the 9J symbol. And this has no geometric meaning in terms of dihedral angle because it's not a geometric object. You cannot draw a triangulation from this object, this graph, because you have intersections.
From one view, the group on the graph, I'm perfectly happy with having a solution, having a relation to a solution is just the whole family at such height. I do not necessarily want me to restrict to just tetrahedra, or just very simple geometric objects. You may think that I'm importing the full quantum gravity, just other
So for the pyramid, do you have a four-valent node at some point?
Here?
Yeah.
Yes, this is a four-valent node in the word, in the picture of the triangulation, which corresponds in the word of spin networks to a square. If you're taking a spin network, which is a part of the spin network, which is a square, and when you want to draw the corresponding triangulation picture, you add a link here, which is that whose length is given by more precisely to each vertex you associate a triangle, and so you have this. And so.
And then when you connect the other four, they all meet somehow, which is what you were just saying. And don't you have to consider a sum over every way that those other four can connect?
Sorry?
Do you have to consider a sum over every possibility for connecting those other
four? Well, we just considered recursion relations or the Hamiltonian constraint or on a single graph. So we haven't.
I'm just wondering if there is a geometrical interpretation for each term in the sum where you get two 6J symbols. And maybe you can throw out the 9J.
If the object is geometric in the sense that it's a product of 6J symbols, then you have a geometric meaning. But if it's more complicated, if, for example, if you have a 9J symbol, or if you have, okay, a cycle which has 5 links, you can obtain a 12J symbol. Those objects are not geometric, and then you cannot have this kind of interpretation. So the question about the sum over each or all possibilities, well,
The point is, you can see the graph that Tiago is just four measurements point. So you can express it in different bases. And in some bases, you get just product of two CJ symbols. And in different bases, you get, for example, 9J symbol, just more than labels, two ways. But when you choose bases, you specify somehow. For example, like the missing length here, then you get more information because you just look at the coefficients of the expansion of this guy and choose a given basis. So somehow you have to choose some over the whole basis. But you can just restrict to one basis. If you have any more questions, I think Pierre is here until Friday.